Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This is G.R. Mobley. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. If you go to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org, you can download our podcast and support documents and links. This is an educational, grassroots program designed to restoring the Republic and placing the general government, or what many refer to as the federal government, back into the constitutional framework and scope of the Constitution. Our toll-free number to call in today is 844-320-4299, and you would do me an immense favor if you would actually call in, because I'd just like to see the chaos, what would happen if the phones rang. Anyway, if you cannot listen to this entire show today, this show will be rebroadcasted on Saturday at 1 p.m., and now it will be also rebroadcast at 9 p.m. on Sunday. So we're now doing two-day rebroadcastings of this show. As well as that, you also know that this is an educational show. I dovetail things. I talk about things like Platonists, and I'm going to get into that. And so consequently, to stay informed and to understand how these things weave together, you really need to download our podcasts and listen to them. I talk to lots of different scholars. I'm just saying that if you don't listen to these conversations that I have with constitutional scholars and so forth, then you're not understanding the context and how, hate to say it, but how right I am on this, that we have the authority and power to take this Constitution back, and we are doing it. We are reclaiming the Republic. Anywho, this Friday, the Republican Coffee Club will be hosting Senator Mark Schosler. I probably just completely butchered his name, so forgive me, Mark. And he's from the 9th District, and he will be talking about good things in his district and legislation and plans for this coming year. Next week, on the 29th, is Chris Voigt. He's the executive director of Potatoes.com. And on the 5th, Colin Sprague, the senior director of government relations for the Avista Corporation, will be coming in to speak about Avista becoming Hydro One, which, come to find out, is a, well, it's Canadian owned, but it looks like it's actually underwritten by the Chinese. And so I think that if you're interested in your rates going up and you want to find out what can be done and getting engaged, January 5th at the Republican Coffee Club, which is the information of the restaurant. I think I don't have it now anymore because it's just on my website. All you got to do is go to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org and go to the links page and look for the Republican Coffee Club. It gives you the address, 7 o'clock in the morning on Fridays, every Friday. And Rob Chase is the host of that, and he's a great host. Anywho, if you're looking for last-minute Christmas gifts, you can always get my books, ebooks, and or hard copy. And as a matter of fact, if you buy my books from MobiusStripPress.com, then I actually sign those, and I sign a little personal note to whomever is the recipient. So you may want to let me know if it's to you or if it's to somebody else. Then you will actually get a personalized message and signature and so forth. I also am planning on having John Hancock and a conversation with John Hancock, the John Hancock, next week. So if you tune in next week on the 27th, we'll be talking to John Hancock for the entire episode, or for at least the last three segments. And I think you'll find it interesting, because John is another one of those historians that understands how America became great, and he understands American exceptionalism and so forth. Also planning on having Tom DeWeese from the American Poly Center on, and we're still trying to find some connections to getting Jim DeMint on. And as the new year starts to open up, I will have a slew of more constitutional guests on, and you'll be overwhelmed with how yet I've not found one person that can claim that Republic Review and that the state's authority over the Constitution has been refuted, not once. And so a lot of people don't like it. They know it's going to be opening up a can of you know what, and so they may say, well, they don't support it, but they can't tell me and they can't tell you that it's unconstitutional and the states don't have that authority. I could go into tax reform. There's probably everybody talking about that. You know, this is the Christmas segment because this coming weekend is Christmas Eve and Christmas on Monday. And so my take on tax reform is it's really simple, folks. If we do Republic Review, then the government no longer spends money on unconstitutional powers, which is over 80% of what they spend is unconstitutional. And so if they take away 80% of their spending, then guess what? Why are they taxing you? Because there's no justification for you having to pay income tax at all. We can get rid of the 16th Amendment. We don't even have to worry about tax reform. We've basically put the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution, and now they can really do, focus on the job that they're supposed to do, and America really can be great again. Could talk about the UN, all these fiascos going on, the move of Tel Aviv, the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. Yeah, there's all sorts of stuff. The one thing that you hear Trump and Nikki Haley talking about, we're taking names and so forth. Why? Why are they even messing with this? Because during the campaign, I remember Trump stating that the UN was irrelevant. We should just get out of it. And why is that not the conversation to go, you know what? We really don't care what you think and where we have our embassies. The question is, where are you going to put the new headquarters for the UN? Because we're done with it. We're out. We're no longer funding this, and you no longer have quick access to our cash. Shut it down. Shut down our presence in the UN, as we'll just send an ambassador, what have you, even if we want to play in that anymore, because it's irrelevant. We don't have to give our sovereignty to an unconstitutional entity that just wants to basically destroy our Constitution and our way of life. Spokane campaign finance, there's plenty of news on this. And as far as I'm concerned, what happened in the city council this week is basically they're setting themselves up so that no way can anybody really fund and finance a true conservative, and they've made it easier and easier for lucre and dirty money from the unions and so forth to come in and buy up more and more progressive positions. Now this, I believe, stands in, you know, it's in violation of the RCW and so forth. So there's going to be some issues that still need to come out from this. But it's just one of those things that you go, really? Why is it that Spokane continually puts these progressives? And it's not that Spokane is doing this, because remember that there was only 30% of the electorate that voted in Spokane, which means that even though they may have won by 60%, that's 60% of 30%. So that's not even a mandate. It's less than one-fifth of the voters are actually happy and putting these people in. And they're running your city into the potential next Detroit, into the next Baltimore. Do you want this? We need to focus on Christmas. So the last note that I'm going to talk about is rodeos. I've been talking a lot with a lot of people about doing what I'm going to call rodeos for Republic Review. We're going to be doing these in six different states, in Wyoming, Utah, Idaho, the Dakotas, and Kansas. The dates and everything else are going to be panning out, and what, who, and how, and so forth, and people. So I'll give you more information on this, but don't be surprised if you actually see this year states either getting the heat on, or who knows, we might actually be lucky to get a couple of these states to actually initiate an audit on the Constitution and call for Republic Review. And so if this actually starts happening, then everybody's wishes, you know, will be probably fulfilled, because, you know, I don't have to be on the air anymore. I can go on off and do other things because I've actually got the country back on the right track. Anyway, let me also give you this other little positive note. I'm hoping to get Northwest Grassroots in here on a consistent basis so that they can talk about their education nights. And I think this is really important that there's local grassroots organizations that are providing you the information on the Hearst decision and what your local legislators are doing to you, what's going on here in Spokane, Spokane County, and so forth. Eastern Washington, the West Coast, they bring you relevant content and they do a great job in presenting this. And so I'm trying to make sure that they have a segment of time each month to talk about what they're doing that month or the upcoming month and so forth. So hopefully we'll have a regular time for them to provide you this information so that you can get more and more involved in helping. I've also mentioned that I'm going to be expanding my Tuesday show. We're just waiting for some closings on some finances as far as, you know, commercial backers, so forth and so on. If you're looking to advertise, call us here at KSBN Studios, or you can send me an email, info@reclaimingtherepublic.org or mobiusstrippress.com. And with that, I hear the music coming in. And so when we come back, we're going to get into kicking Santa Claus, or actually I'm going to give you the truth about Christmas. So please stay tuned, and we'll be right back after a word from our sponsors. Okay, so we are back, and I talk a lot about Platonism on this show, and so there's probably no greater mark of the current Platonists as far as when they started injecting themselves in our society than the grand manipulation of Christmas and what we ended up basically creating that kind of spread around the world, because Christmas was not what you think it is. Keep in mind, the Platonist efforts began in 1776, and the effort was a direct contrast to what the framers were doing here in our republic in establishing individual liberty and individual sovereignty. They were seeking subjugation to the state and to a grand state, a global state. So, as a perceived good for all, the Platonists did what they believed was necessary for setting the stage for future manipulations. This is why an accurate historic perspective is paramount for looking at the history of Christmas, and being somebody that's kind of fascinated by history, I kind of like understanding these things. How did, you know, why is it that we have these symbols and so forth? Because they were injected into this. And the accuracy that you're going to get is obviously going to be based on my filters, on my research, and so forth. But I would ask you, if you actually started looking at the real history of Christmas, you will kind of find out that it's really been more of a sham, and I'm going to get into that. In the early 17th century, a wave of religious reform changed the way Christmas was celebrated in Europe. This was during the America's first religious awakening. If you remember, this coinciding about the same time was this new religious awakening in the 17th century, which was a move here in America towards religious tolerance. As a matter of fact, I believe Maryland in 1668, something like that, passed a tolerance law where, in other words, there wasn't going to be a dominant Christian church. They were going to be tolerant towards all different Christian churches. Keep in mind, they weren't tolerant towards any other churches as far as faith goes. As long as they were Christian in nature, they were going to tolerate them, and they weren't going to create wars like what was happening in Europe. So, in Europe, there's this guy by the name of Oliver Cromwell and his Puritan forces who took over England in 1645. And they vowed to rid England of the decadence and the debauchery that was coming with these winter wildings, is what I like to call them. And so they basically canceled Christmas and, you know, these wildings, because at this point in time, Christmas did not take on this new form of actual Christmas. It was a winter holiday. Well, later on, Charles II was restored to the throne, and with him came the return of the popular pagan holiday. And so in his return, this was the precursor to the Glorious Revolution. If you kind of look at these events as how they went down this path, so England swung back towards the debauchery, and that's when they basically, you know, kind of unleashed, and then Charles was opposed, and they got themselves James and a whole new king, and they started moving towards a more religious and bringing, you know, more of a Christness to Christmas, but it still was not the Christmas that you know of, celebrating the birth of Christ and all of those things. So the pilgrims, basically the separatists, as we know, and we talked about this for Thanksgiving, came to America in the 1620s, and basically they were very orthodox and puritanistic, and they followed Cromwell's beliefs of, you know, not celebrating Christmas. Again, I kind of spoke about these guys and their failure in trying to attempt to establish a socialism government. And the term the Tragic of the Commons came from that, because nobody wanted to abide by the law, because everybody wanted to take care of themselves. And that's just the nature of people. Anyway, this pagan version of Christmas was still not a holiday here in America. And from 1659 to 1681, the celebration of the pagan Christmas was actually outlawed in Boston. Anyone exhibiting the Christmas spirit or the pagan spirit, in other words, if you were drunk and disorderly, or, you know, drinking too much in the wintertime, you were going to be arrested, and they actually fined you 5 shillings, which was a pretty good tax back then. In contrast, in Jamestown, the settlement, the captain John Smith reported that the pagan Christmas was enjoyed and all passed without incident. The interesting thing is, he had to actually say that it passed without incident, because it wasn't as wilding as it was in Europe. And so if you look at what happened after the American Revolution in England, the customs fell out of favor as far as anything that we were doing that was popular in England, such as celebrating Christmas and so forth. The state stopped doing this here. And as a matter of fact, in the very first session of Congress in December 25th, 1789, Congress was actually in session working. It was not even recognized, and it was one of those things, we're not doing that. And so Christmas wasn't declared actually a federal holiday until 1870, almost a century later. So up to this point, this pagan holiday was not even a Christian event, and it wasn't really dovetailed towards Christ. And there was no association up to this point, truly, with like the birth of Christ and these significant things that we know were just all concocted. In the 19th century, in 1800s, Americans began to embrace the pagan Christmas. And as a matter of fact, this embracement of this pagan Christmas was really more of getting drunk, disorderly, and what it led to was a very wilding type of season. So what ended up happening was this enlisted the reinvention of Christmas, and it basically changed from a loud and rowdy type of carnival holiday to a family-centered day of peace and nostalgia. But how did they do this? And so what ended up happening in converting this riotous holiday to something that became spiritual kind of really piqued my interest. And so at the end of the 18th century was the beginning of the class conflict and the turmoil. So after the French Revolution had basically ended and Napoleon was rising to power, and all of that in itself was a class warfare. The peasants basically overthrew the crown. And here in America, this was starting to come here as well. This class concept was becoming more and more prevalent. And in the early 19th century, unemployment was high, gang rioting by the disenchanted classes was rising, and often occurred during what they called the Christmas season, was lots of property loss, property damage. People were being hurt through these winter wildings. It was so bad that in 1828, the New York City Council instituted the first city police force in response to Christmas rioting. So that was America's early beginning of Christmas. Again, it had no ties towards Christianity. So what ended up happening was these events of this rioting and this class warfare galvanized elitists because the people that were being hurt were those who owned property and those who had lots of money. And so these elitists began changing through the controls of the media and so forth, how we celebrated Christmas in America. And they started doing this in 1819 when Washington Irving wrote the classic, The Sketchbook of Jeffrey Crayon, and he was basically an English gent. And this series of stories is about the celebration of Christmas in an English manner and how it shifted the paradigm of Christmas, because in this celebration, he was embracing the poor, helping them, bringing them in, and what's also coming in is a hard break. So you're going to have to stay tuned to get the rest of the story, and we will be right back after word from our sponsors. So please stay tuned. Okay, so where were we? I believe we were just talking about Washington Irving and his sketchbook of Jeffrey Crayon and this English gent who was this great bloke who brought in the poor, his servants and so forth, and they shared eggnog and so forth. And so, again, there was really nothing of, it was Christ-like behavior, but it didn't interweave the birth and the wise men and all of that into Christmas. And so the stories were really about, like, again, this English squire who invited these peasants into his home, and in contrast to the problems faced in the American society and what was going on in the real world, these two groups supposedly mingled effortlessly. In Irving's mind, Christmas was a peaceful, warm-hearted holiday bringing groups together across lines of wealth and social status. In Irving's fictional celebrations, because none of these were true, the disparate classes enjoyed what we imagined were ancient customs. And he basically spelled these out as, you know, as it had been done for years, for generations. So in Irving's book series was not based on any holiday celebration he had attended. And in fact, historians say that Irving's account actually invented the tradition by implying that it described the true customs of the season. The early 19th century was, again, also what was going on here in America was a second awakening. At the exact same time, the evangelical faith was beginning as the Republic was beginning to enjoy peace. So this second awakening, the evangelical faith was coming, and America was finally finishing its revolution with Britain, because the War of 1812 was really the end to British hostilities and accepting our true independence. Most people think that the war ended in 1783-84 with some of the treaties, but they never did, because Britain never honored those. What ended up happening was we actually had to go to war again because they burnt down Washington, D.C. And so in going to war, we finally had the Treaty of Ghent. And that was truly the end of the American Revolution in the grand scheme of things. Even though we were an autonomous nation and trying to function, Britain was impressing our sailors and so forth. So anyway, I digress on that history. The whole point is that in 1817, at the end of Madison's presidency, was truly when America no longer had to look over its shoulder towards Britain and the rest of the world, because we actually, you know, kicked some butt, and the world took notice that, hey, these guys aren't going to take it anymore, and so they had to change how they treated us. Well, in the internal goings-ons of America, again, was this reawakening evangelical thing, as well as this pagan celebration that was becoming a real problem. In addition, the abolition movement started getting truly entrenched in America. And actually, former President John Quincy Adams, this was in I want to say 1827, whenever he left the presidency, he actually became a senator and served the rest of his life as a senator fighting slavery and promoting the abolition movement. Shortly after he became a senator is when the Democrats actually instituted the gag rule on the Senate floor on slavery. In other words, basically making it impossible for anybody to talk about slavery in the Senate. And so he was still fighting, and he basically dedicated his life trying to end the slavery. As such, the North and the South were completely divided on not just slavery, but they were also divided on the issue of Christmas. Many Northerners saw sin in the celebration of the wilding and debauchery and drunkenness and so forth. And so they felt that Thanksgiving truly was America's righteous holiday, as I told you last month, and that they looked at the winter wilding as a scourge, and so they did not celebrate, and they maintained this, if you want to call it celibacy or whatever, they did not recognize it, and it was actually starting to happen in New York as it started migrating north. And so in the South, Christmas was an important part of the social season. Not surprisingly, the first three states to make Christmas a legal holiday were in the South: Alabama in 36, Louisiana in 1838, and Arkansas in 1838 as well. In the years after the Civil War, Christmas tradition spread across the country, and the whole country had gone lock, stock, barrel into this modifying of Christmas. The children's books became an important part of molding the future minds. It's just like today. Why is it that we have so many communists? Why is it that we have a real decline in attending religious meetings or going to church on Sundays and honoring the Sabbath and so forth? Because we've been inculcated and or indoctrinated to believing we don't need these things. And so back then, children's books actually were an important part and an integral part in helping establish customs in how to celebrate Christmas, especially the tradition of trimmed trees and gifts delivered by Santa Claus. So here's that first word, Santa. The interesting thing is, back in those days, anagrams were huge, and they liked to play with anagrams. And there's an anagram with Santa. If you rearrange the letters, you can also have Satan. And so it was pointed out that there was this anagram between Santa and Satan. So whether whoever concocted this, because that was way back in Europe and the translations and so forth were a little bit different, but bottom line, there is an anagram there, and whether that was something that was by design, I don't know, but I do know that Dad is Ad and Mom is Mom. Anyway, back to this little history here. Sunday school classes started encouraging, and this was during the 1800s, the 19th century, Sunday school classes started encouraging the celebration of this new Christian version of Christmas. And even though they hadn't nailed down the real date of when Christ was born, they said, "Oh, this is when we're going to do it." And so now we know that I believe historians have proven that Christ was actually born in the springtime, or right about the same time he was crucified. And so now that we've got that truth out of the way, they just concocted this whole thing. They just said, "Well, let's throw a dart at it, and this is the day we're going to celebrate it. This is how we're going to do this." Anyway, women's magazines became an integral part in suggesting ways to start decorating and creating holiday traditions, as well as, you know, what to do as far as baking, the goodies, so forth. And so they started creating these standards, and before the end of the century, it was just out of hand. At this time, literature and the progressive press had begun to congeal in manipulating social affairs. And so why were they doing this? Well, one, it was getting the elitists to focus off of the class warfare here in America, and, you know, from them losing property, getting hurt, bodily damage, that type of stuff. And so that was one thing that was happening, but there was this boom that people started spending money because it became a revenue maker that people were now exchanging gifts. So they started piping in these things of gifts, and the, you know, that's why the birth of the Savior, the wise men giving gifts and so forth. And so it became a real commercial effort. In 1870, President Ulysses S. Grant declared Christmas an actual legal holiday. The bill to make Christmas a holiday was introduced in the House of Representatives by Burton Chauncey Cook of Illinois. It was approved and passed on to the Senate in June 24th, and both houses had agreed on the wording. It passed to the president, who signed it June 28th in 1870. Here's the wording of that act of Congress, and please bear in mind, I want you to go back and listen to my Thanksgiving show, because I played the proclamation from George Washington on Thanksgiving, and how I'm telling you that is our sacred holiday that we should be making sacred. Anyway, the words go as this: an act making the first day of January, the 25th day of December, the 4th day of July, and Thanksgiving Day holidays within the District of Columbia, be it enacted by the Senate and House of Representatives of the United States of America in Congress assembled, that the following days, to wit, the first day of January, commonly called New Year's Day, the 4th day of July, the 25th day of December, commonly called Christmas, and any day appointed or recommended by the President of the United States as a day of public fast or Thanksgiving shall be holidays within the District of Columbia. Up, oh, I won't be able to finish this bill or this act because we've got a hard break here. So when we come back, I'll finish this and I'll wrap this up for you. And now you'll know the real story behind Christmas. So please stay tuned, and we will be right back after a word from our sponsors. Okay, so let me finish up this act that Congress had passed and that the president had signed. And I'm continuing on here, and shall for all purposes of presenting for payment or acceptance of the maturity and protest and giving notice of the dishonor of bills of exchange, bank checks, and promissory notes and other negotiable or commercial paper be treated and considered as is the first day of the week, commonly called Sunday, and all notes, drafts, checks, and other commercial or notable paper falling due or maturing on either said holiday shall be deemed as having matured on the day previous. By the last quarter of the 19th century, America eagerly decorated trees, caroled, baked, and shopped for Christmas season. Since that time, materialism, media, advertising, and mass marketing has made Christmas what it is today. The reason I read that act for you is because nowhere in there were they recognizing Christmas as a spiritual holiday or anything like that. Now, again, I'm not necessarily trying to, you know, kick Santa in the teeth or, you know, trying to bring down your Christmas. The traditions that we enjoy at Christmas today were invented by blending together customs from many different countries into what is considered by many to be a national holiday. That said, and there's been many people that have been asserting that there's been this war on Christmas, taking down nativity scenes, and you've heard me say many times that this is a Christian nation. It was established as a Christian nation. Read that Thanksgiving proclamation. That was a Christian holiday recognizing the divine hand of providence, giving us our Constitution and establishing this nation. Go read it. That said, many Christians today may not know the details of Christmas, but almost all know that it was a pagan origin holiday that was infused with celebrating the birth of Christ. As Christians, we can choose when we celebrate the birth of Christ and our Savior, but we must remember that we have adopted a spirit to this holiday that sets it apart. We know that Christ was not really born at this time of year. Bringing people together in his name, though, is always a good thing, whether that be December 25th or whether that be February 14th, whether that be any other day of the year when we can bring people together in His name, that's always a good thing. So let us not surrender this time of year we call Christmas to paganism that we're starting to see more and more. Let us instead focus on the spirit of the holiday, which is Him. Instead, let's make His spirit the new norm to this and every season. If we moved away from the commercialization of Christmas and towards giving of one's talents, time, and sustenance to those who are truly in need, and what we would call Christian compassionate service, then I truly believe that this nation and our communities and so forth will be blessed. Service in His name is divine. And so by saying all of that, I would like to wish you a very, very Merry Christmas. Now, there's a study that just came out in 2016, the Pew Research, and they just came out with this report. And I actually posted this on my Mobius Strip Press Facebook page, as well as my GR Mobley Facebook page. And I invite you to go read it. We have basically crossed the threshold of becoming a godless nation. There's literally less than 50% of true Christian people going to church. And I don't think out of the 50%, because they're blending all, it's religious, period. And so I don't believe that 100% of that 50% that are attending church services are Christian. And so we've actually crossed over that threshold where less than 50% are considered active and are believers in Christianity and or practicing believers in Christianity. So that right there, folks, is an indictment, and that right there is a report card of success of the education system. If you want to know where our ills are really hitting us and hurting us the most, it is our education system. And I am basically here to tell you that there's only one way to take this back, and to one way to get that monopoly of narrative out of our school system, and that's by Republic Review taking back the powers of the states, because the federal government doesn't have the constitutional authority to run the education system and to take our money and give it back to us if they want to. That's our money. They don't have the constitutional authority over that. The states do. And as a matter of fact, the states could easily take back the Department of Transportation, the Department of Education, Energy, all of these unconstitutional governments or forms of departments and so forth. There's 12. When I started the show last February, I started telling you, well, it looks like, you know, I still need to be doing this show because there's no sight down the road of seeing any of these departments going away and going away in the right way, where the states have asserted their authority and said, this is our responsibility, not yours. You can't tax us on this and you can't spend this money on that. We never delegated that power to you. Now, if you want, we can go and you can call with a couple minutes left. That would create panic here, pandemonium. But I would basically tell you that our government at the local level as well as at the federal level has just been going unchecked. And it's our responsibility, folks. And I want to kind of focus on really what has to happen to start changing what you're getting in government. Because bottom line, there are insidious organizations that are funneling money into progressive candidates so that they can basically start controlling and monopolizing the campaigns so that only they can get the money. And they're making it harder and harder for local businesses and good people to get involved and supporting good candidates. And so what has to happen is you as the electorate and, you know, the person of power with your vote and so forth, need to start asserting yourself, and you need to get out there. It's a time of a new change, new resolutions. Make 2018 the year we start really reclaiming the Republic in ways that matter here at a local level, at the state level, and so forth, at the level of the Republic. And so I would ask you to start supporting businesses that don't surrender to political correctness. Start supporting businesses that are, you know, out there supporting conservative causes and supporting taking back our Constitution, because the businesses that are choosing to take down this this politically correct path, because believe me, I've talked to a lot of businesses in this area. They don't want to support any type of program that supports the Constitution. I go, you got to be kidding me. Really? Do you not know what's coming down the road? As a matter of fact, when I talk to car dealerships, and I've talked to a couple, and I try to remind them what happened in 2009, you guys should have vested interest in protecting the Constitution and ensuring that the government doesn't come back in and close you down. Because in 2009, when that whole debacle of violating contract law with both GM and Chrysler, those dealerships around the nation were arbitrarily picked by government to which ones could stay open and which ones couldn't. Show me the Constitution where they could do that. And that's going to happen again. As a matter of fact, all indications are is that Ford is starting to, you know, have problems. And I don't think they're in this really big boom unless everybody constantly buys and throws away cars every year. They're just making way too many, and they're doing too much because the unions are driving this, and the unions are self-serving to destroy us. Bottom line, you need to start supporting those that are actually supporting the Constitution. When you walk into a store, ask, hey, how do you feel about the Constitution? And if they want to play politically correct, you know, well, we try not to talk about that, then fine. Go spend your money elsewhere. Start supporting those who are working in businesses, because we need businesses to start getting involved in supporting good constitutional candidates. Businesses are the local leaders as well as your local grassroots leaders and so forth. I mean, I am just a voice of reason. I've done lots of research, and I'm here to help, and I've got lots of leadership training, and I want to apply that leadership training. But I don't want to run for election, and I don't want to be a public servant. Bottom line, you need to start finding good constitutional public servants that you can start placing into those vacant spots in PCOs in the GOP. You can start getting active and making sure that those who are working in the local GOP understand the Constitution and support it and support constitutional platforms instead of agendas. The political leadership in this county has basically allowed you and threw you under the bus in this last election because they managed this election instead of leading in this election. I think that there's some of the leaders that were good, but I can tell you that some of the elected leadership on the Republican side threw you under the bus, and we can get more into that as this next year comes up. We will be doing the year end with John Hancock next week, so make sure you tune in and you can listen to John Hancock from the grave. This is Reclaiming the Republic. I'm G.R. Mobley, and we'll see you next week. Thank you very much, and God bless.